hearing on House Bill 2216. Although basically what we're talking about today is the Senate bill. So here we go.
Okay, we opened the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services. And first of all, I have an announcement somewhere.
I'm pushing my way in.
Okay, the Senate bill, or the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services will meet on Friday in Coos Bay, North Bend. We're going to have our regular committee meeting this coming Friday, the 9th of February. Senator Joanne Berger will host us. We will be meeting at the hospital in Coos Bay, and we'll deal with a number of issues. We're going to take input from the public on a number of issues. We will have a hearing on a health care, rural health bill while we're there. Senate bill, okay. We're going to have to call back Senate Bill 184, the 2% gross revenue on the sales of liquor, because there was, we didn't quite get the announcement in on time, and so we're going to have to do that one over. So that will be on Monday, February 11th. That is Senate Bill 184. Pardon me. Somebody just said February 12th. Good. Okay. Thank you. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 162. We do have a couple of amendments which we will deal with a little bit later. Okay, Jeannie Smith.
Is that 362?
Senate Bill 362. Okay. Senate Bill 362.
Chair Morissette and Chair Greenlick, I am disguised as Janine Smith, the Administrator of the Office of Health Policy, representing Reese Sailors. Here today, who sends her regrets. She's unable to attend due to health reasons. The Governor's Office would like to extend its gratitude to Senator Morissette and Representative Greenlick, whose efforts have been instrumental in creating and expanding the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. As Missy Dolan, the program's administrator, will briefly highlight for as at least half of the committee, this joint committee today, has get a brief overview of the program. This began in the 03-05 session and is steadily growing to provide significant savings to the uninsured Oregonians and public groups in their purchase of prescription drugs. OPDP has been one of the governor's priorities, and both he and you, the legislature, have embraced it with the passage of, in addition, with the passage of Measure 44, again, thanks to the efforts of Senator Morissette and Representative Greenlick and our partners such as AARP, Oregonians for Healthcare Security, the Oregon Business Alliance, and others, OPDP has the citizens' endorsement. This new legislation, Senate Bill 362, allows Oregon's businesses, many who struggle with the cost of providing health care coverage for their employees, to participate in this bulk purchasing program. And the governor is very excited to work with you and to expand the program. Briefly looking at the Dash 1, we feel very comfortable with those and excited to work with you on those. Briefly looking at Dash 2, which you're going to talk about later, we would be concerned because it would require the program to do some significant expensive survey work outside of what is in the governor's recommended budget and the Office of Health Policy and Research's budget, which lives within the Department of Administrative Services. And on that note, I'll turn it over to Missy to give a brief overview of the program.
Okay. Any questions so far? Okay. Thank you. Missy?
Thank you, Janine. Chair Morissette and Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today and tell you about the program and to address 362 and its impact and the amendment's impact on the program. I've done a brief slide presentation, and starting with slide 2, I've listed some milestones for the program, starting with the passage of Senate Bill 875 through the support of Senator Morissette and Representative Greenlick in September of 2003. The program was actually launched in March of 2005. You'll note that the next four bullets show that in 2006 we had some pretty, we were pretty active in strategic goals. We formed an interstate consortium in July with the state of Washington. We had the passage of Measure 44 in November, thanks to Senator Morissette, Jerry Cohen of AARP, Oregonians for Health Security, and all of our advocate friends. Measure 44 was enacted a month later on December 7th, and in November of, In November, on November 28th, the consortium actually signed its first collaborative contract with the ODS companies to administer our programs both in Oregon and Washington. And then that contract became effective last week on February 1st. Between the passage of Measure 44, the time it was enacted, and the end of January, we actually enrolled another 6,800 people in the program. In the last week of January, we sent 10,800 welcome packets out, and that amounted, like I said, 6,800 new members. At today, I'm pretty sure we're at about 12,000, and I would not be at all surprised if we have 15,000 uninsured members enrolled by the end of the month. I'm on to slide three. I'm saying 12,500 members enrolled as of today. Average savings for the program for the past 22 months are about $28 per prescription. We've saved a total of $840,000 through January since inception. And the new potential pool has about 1 million Oregonians who are eligible to join. Next slide, why form an interstate consortium?
I'm sorry, that's the new one, meaning the one for Measure 44?
That's correct.
Okay. Not this particular bill.
No. On to slide four, why form an interstate consortium? And I say other than a shared vision, and I think the shared vision is very, very important. Both Washington and Oregon share a vision that the other states who have done discount programs don't really share, and that is to bring the same level of discount and the same level of service to the uninsured population that the insured members in the state receive. Oregon's perspective is that prior to the passage of Measure 44, we had about 500,000 to 550,000 eligible Oregonians. And we had a good contract in place with our former pharmacy benefit administrator, Walgreens Health Initiatives. However, the contract that we were able to negotiate with the ODS companies using a potential pool of nearly 6 million members is significantly greater than the contract that we had previously. The new contract brings us what I think is probably one of the best RX purchasing contracts that a group in either Washington or Oregon could negotiate on their own. Washington's perspective, they had the statute authorizing this huge pool of theirs, but they didn't have an existing infrastructure, so they came down here and literally adopted our infrastructure, and they started adopting all of our contracts and putting their Washington regulatory requirements into them, but they didn't have to start from scratch like the OPBP did. On to the next slide. The next steps for the program, beginning on Friday, we're going to have a stakeholder meeting with AARP, Oregonians for Health Security, OSPIRG, all of the advocate groups that championed Measure 44 and that, quite honestly, have championed OPDP through the current day, and they're in the room with us today. they are going to plan with us an outreach strategy in every county in this state to try to reach the uninsured that are eligible, with virtually no marketing since December 7th of go live for Measure 44. We expanded by 6,800 members, and I think with some real outreach with the help of our friends, we can really make some significant growth in this pool. The implications of Senate Bill 362, one of the things that I want to point out is the wording adds the underinsured to the individual population. We have gotten calls from people who have wonderful health savings accounts, but with high deductibles like $5,000, and they say, well, Missy, I really don't consider that I have RX coverage. And I said, well, legally, I would consider that you have RX coverage. You just have a high deductible. And they said, but we'll never reach it. And that's where the underinsured language in this Senate bill will help those people. They're still buying prescription drugs, paying out of pocket, and they could use a good discount. The other side of the Senate bill increases the potential group market. I want to say that right now the group market is just the public sector business, and we actually at the beginning of 2006 we had about 4,000 members enrolled. Two of the groups have chosen to go elsewhere. They wanted to be fully insured. It's difficult when you have a small group of or a small market to draw on to get the kind of growth that we need for ramp up to achieve critical mass. The bigger the market to draw on, the quicker we're going to ramp up, the quicker we'll reach critical mass. I'd like to address Amendment 1. We fully support the items in Measure 1, Amendment 1, because they reduce unnecessary cost and burden to the program. Issuing annual ID cards and making people apply annually is really a cost factor. Postage alone, not to mention sending out, if we're successful and can enroll half of the uninsured in this state, we're talking 200,000 to 300,000, and there's no need to send a new ID cards every 12 months and to have these people fill out applications. So we're going to be cutting down a lot of our Oregon trees to fulfill that requirement. Amendment 1 takes that requirement away. Amendment 2, I just want to say, has got, like Dr. Smith said, Dr. Smith is administrator for the Oregon Health Policy and Research Division. Her data section actually is in charge of statewide surveys on a continuing basis. And in collaboration with her, we've recognized that the requirements under Amendment 2 would cause significant financial impact for the OPDP. We are a staff of one right now. I have requested money for my colleague Betty's salary in the new budget, in the governor's budget. Two people will not be able to fulfill the requirements of Amendment 2. It will require that we either pay Janine's office to do it, and we don't have money to pay her office to do it, or hire external consultants to do it. On another note, I just like to tell you that we are not collecting the data that this amendment requires, nor do the pharmacies all have electronic mail, so we can't do things electronically with them. As a matter of fact, most of the pharmacies in this state and all of the independents prefer fax, not electronic mail. So we're going to be increasing paper transactions, and it kind of takes my breath away to talk about Amendment 2. On to the
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. But if the purpose of the program is truly to give people options for the lowest priced drugs, why wouldn't we go there? Because that could clearly give them an option for something lower priced.
I think that, Chair Greenlick, Chair Morissette, and Vice Chair Cruz, We have demonstrated the lowest price for this program. When we did the solicitation and negotiation last fall for which ODS Companies was awarded the contract, we actually used a group in Washington with 165,000 lives. We used 6 months of their data, and that was over 2 million prescription drug claims. And we repriced it within the parameters of the new program, which included ingredient cost, dispensing fee, point of service. It included administrative cost. It included guaranteed rebate, not the real rebate, which would be higher. So all five elements of the algorithm, we reran those 2 million plus claims on a very tightly managed program in Washington, and we demonstrated credible savings. We then took those rates and that whole algorithm of cost elements and applied that to the program. That was our negotiating point with the ODS companies. That is what we presented to the pharmacies in this state, and that's what we presented to the pharmacies in Washington. A group of 165,000 lives is greater than PEB here, and it is it's already got very competitive rates. So for us to be able to demonstrate savings for a group that large is phenomenal. Those are the rates we're bringing to the individuals. Even with the rates that we had in the former program, every time we repriced, if we had credible data from the carriers or the PBMs, we demonstrated savings. This is hands down a better contract. Hands down. So we have already done a due diligence to guarantee that this is very competitive in the market. And I would be willing to take this to our PAB or any of the big groups in this state, and I'm sure I can demonstrate savings. So to, you know, this is, I'm not saying that this would not be a worthwhile amendment. I think that if we had a data unit and we wanted to put the resources to run this, I think it would be excellent. And we could come back with glowing reports to you. But I'm willing to say we have run it up front. We've done the due diligence. And now those big groups in Washington are prepared to look at ODS. They're actually required by statute to look at this pool in Washington. To demonstrate that their existing carrier is not better than this pool. So that's going on as we speak.
Mr. Chair, I guess from my perspective, and that may all be well and fine, but I haven't seen the data from Washington. I haven't seen the list of pharmacies. I haven't seen any of the baseline in this thing to have a real comparison. Okay. So,
good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And my question is, I mean, essentially, you're looking at this dash two as essentially an unfunded mandate. And, you know, I run a small health clinic, and we get unfunded mandates and don't have the opportunity to pick and choose which ones we apply. And if we are actually looking for lowest price and the consumer can save some money as a result of this report, then I think it does warrant a serious review. And further, I also, you know, your comment about pharmacies not having email, our pharmacies that we deal with, you know, we deal with fax, but I've yet to see a pharmacy that doesn't have email. So,
Representative Greenlick and Chair Morissette and Representative Maurer, I appreciate that they all do probably have email, but they don't take communication from us through email. Most of them require that we use fax. And that was demonstrated. We sent our amendment that was going to be effective February 1 out in December and then again in January. And today we are still receiving calls from pharmacies who said we haven't received it yet. So even the faxes get lost. And they said, do you have any idea of the number of emails, of faxes, et cetera? Now will you fax it again? And to your point about... I acknowledge that mandates don't always come with the money to finance them, but I would have to request funding if this was mandated of my two-person department. And one of the things that we are already doing is providing a tool to all members that join the program, and that tool is a drug purchasing guide, and it's the most commonly used therapeutic classes, and it shows the drug cost for the drugs that the Health Resource Commission, using the Oregon Health Sciences studies, has determined, and in conjunction with our P&T committee, Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, has determined to be as effective in each of those therapeutic classes. And we put dollar signs by each one and a happy face if the drug is under $10. So we actually have an 82% generic usage rate in our uninsured population. That's greater than any discount program in the United States because we are providing that education. Again, back to the point of our philosophy, we believe that the uninsured deserve the same education, the same service that the insured population is getting today. All of us with insurance get tips on better purchasing. Why are you buying an expensive brand if there's an equally effective generic alternative? It's helpful for access that the uninsured are using that tool. So on to
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you, sir. I don't have the statute in front of me. We're walking over to find it. Is there anything in the statute that suggests we're trying to provide the very lowest price possible to?
Chair Greenlick and Chair Morissette, the statute actually has lowest price. It says that we will provide, develop a drug list, and that we will bring lowest price.
Can you tell me which section of the statute says that?
I don't have the statute in front of me either.
Here's the statute.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll find it.
Mr. Chair, I think it's in. I think I found it. I don't think it says lowest price. If I may, I think it says best possible price.
Oh, best. Thank you.
And it's on line line 21 on the front of Senate Bill 362.
I do have a follow-up. If that's what it says, what do you suppose best possible price means?
Chair Greenlick.
Or lowest possible, whatever is that.
Chair Greenlick and Chair Morris said, I think that the best possible price is the price that we've put together with the ODS companies, because we demonstrated the best possible price using the 165,000 life group analyzing, repricing 2 million claims.
Thank you, sir. Lowest possible cost.
Yes. It says both, Mr. Chair.
Oh, it says both.
Two lines down it says.
Let's see. Who wrote that?
Okay, other questions? Thank you very much. Don't go away too far, though.
I'm sorry.
I thought you were done. Okay.
Chair Moore said I have one more slide, and that is, why is the OPDP good for Oregon? And on the uninsured side, it increases access to prescription drugs to people who couldn't otherwise afford it. I think that the passage of Measure 44 by 78% of the population shows that most Oregonians who were voting certainly agree with that. It also brings groups what might be the best purchasing vehicle of prescription drugs in terms of cost, auditable transparency, and financially guaranteed services.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Mary Beth Healy, Laura Hetherington, Andy Miller. Would you all come up, please?
This is a formidable panel.
Yes. Mary Beth, do you want to lead off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Greenlick, Chair Morissette. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Healy. I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security. And I have to say, I'm really excited to be here today to talk about the missing link with the very successful Oregon Prescription Drug Program. For many of you, you know that Oregonians for Health Security is a statewide nonprofit healthcare advocacy organization working to increase access and decrease costs of healthcare and provide quality, affordable, and secure healthcare for all Oregonians. Every day we hand deliver to your offices the Daily Dose, which is the story of an Oregonian and their struggle with the high cost of health care, and in many cases it is around prescription drugs. Beginning in 2003, we've actually been advocating for prescription drug purchasing pools to reduce the cost of health care broadly, but also to reduce the cost of prescription drugs. And the reason is that, and this goes directly to Senate Bill 362, and why we want to expand this to the private sector. Prescription drug costs are average 14 to 20% of overall premiums. The average family premium is now over $11,000 a year. And so when I talk to businesses around this state, they're very concerned about the high cost of health care. They're very concerned about their ability to be able to provide health care for their employees. Last year, we had a 15.7% increase in our health insurance at our small nonprofit. That's a big increase. Now, this year, it was only 6.6%, and I'm supposed to be happy about that, which I'm really, I am happy it's not 15.7, but I'm not tremendously happy about it. And opening up this pool will benefit all of us. It will clearly benefit the Oregonians that are already in, enrolled in the program, but it will also help to stabilize and hopefully decrease the cost of premiums for Oregon businesses. I want to talk a little bit about some of the people that have benefited from this program in the past. One of the families was actually profiled in the Daily Dose today. And, Senator, this goes to your point about the underinsured. And this the woman's name is Mavis Jacobs. She lives in Portland. She and her family used to be on the Oregon Health Plan. Her husband got a job, and now they have insurance through their employer. However, they have a high deductible with their prescription drug coverage, and their prescription drug needs are much higher. And so they have not really been able to access the health care that they need. And her message to you, if I can find it on my thing here, was, you know, they thought they were doing the right thing by signing up for private health insurance through their employer, but now they can't access their services and would like to be able to access the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. Employers around Oregon are in that same boat. They're trying to do the right thing, and I think that it is really an opportune time for the Oregon legislature to expand this program to the private sector. That would make us on par with Washington, so it's all public and private employers, and really give us more negotiating power to reduce the cost of prescription drugs and health care broadly. Thank you very much for your time.
Questions? Thank you. Laura.
Thank you, Chair Morissette and Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 362. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. OSPIRG is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, statewide public interest advocate. The rising cost of health care affects everyone. It increases costs for individuals and businesses, and it shuts more and more people out of access to the care that they need. Prescription drug prices are a significant piece of the healthcare puzzle, and costs are skyrocketing. In 2005, U.S. consumers spent over $250 billion on prescription drugs. That's nearly $50 billion more than in 2003. The primary reason for this increase is clear: higher prices rising faster than inflation. For example, prices charged by drug makers for brand name pharmaceuticals jumped 3.9% in the first quarter of 2006. That's four times greater than the general rate of inflation during that period. OSPREC supports solutions to reduce healthcare costs and improve quality and accountability. The Oregon Prescription Drug Program has proven itself to be just such a solution. Established in 2003, the program leverages the buying power of the people in the program to negotiate lower prices. It's been shown to deliver savings of up to 60%, and the discounted drugs are available at pharmacies across the state. With passage of Measure 44, the program is now open to all Oregonians lacking drug coverage, as well as to some government entities. This expansion has been critical for people lacking drug coverage. With no one to negotiate on their behalf, folks lacking drug coverage pay the highest prices at the pharmacy. In this past summer, OSPREC conducted a survey around the state of the costs that uninsured folks pay for prescription drugs, finding those costs to be exceedingly high. And in contrast, the prices that the Oregon Prescription Drug Program was able to negotiate for those folks, on average, at least 32% cheaper. So that was a significant savings that we found. And those were on the most expensive brand name drugs. The discounts are even more significant on generic drugs. Now we applaud the sponsors of these bills that will bring the cost savings of the SMART program to even more Oregonians by opening it up both to the private sector and to folks that are underinsured. It makes sense to give businesses this helpful tool to reduce prescription drug costs and the overall cost of health care, and this will expanding the pool will make its ability to negotiate cheaper prices even more effective. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify in favor of this SMART bill.
Thank you, Laura. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me. You know, this is an elementary question, but in your testimony you said some government entities.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I guess my question is, I don't care who my answer is. The question is, who's excluded? And why wouldn't we want to roll those people into this at this point?
Sure.
So when Senate Bill 875, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, when Senate Bill 875 passed in 2003, the eligible enrollees at that time were private sector employers, so state agencies, school districts,
public,
local governments.
Public sector, excuse me.
Thank you, Senator and Representative. Were allowed to be in the pool, as well as individuals who were 54 years and older at or below 185% of federal poverty, or about $18,000 a year. Ballot Measure 44, which passed in this past November, opened up the pool to just individuals. So regardless of age or income, individuals can now join the pool and realize the savings from the negotiated price. So the only excluded group are private sector employers and Taft-Hartley Trust or multi-employer trusts.
Yes.
That's not the question. The question was, in the testimony, was it says as well as to some government entities can't access this program. At least that's how I read it. I'm on the front page of Laura, Ms. Etherton's testimony.
Right.
And so I guess the question is, what government entities are excluded, and why wouldn't, it seems to me, that would be the first group you want to roll into this.
Sure. Chair Greenlick, Chair Morris said, I believe the Oregon Health Plan itself is excluded from participating in this program, and that's what I was referring to.
But all government employees, I think. Pretty much all government employees are.
Why would we not want to roll Oregon Health Plan, at least as a... I mean,
that's a long question.
Yeah.
Complicated question. Yes,
if this is such a good deal, then we need to just open it up to everybody and say, well, then if you don't want to do it, then you don't have to.
Part of the deal, putting Senate Bill 875 together was a complicated matter and included ending up with a lot of collaboration from the pharmacy industry, from labor unions, from a variety of places. One of the conditions of the negotiation was that there be a firewall between this and the Medicaid program. And it was one of the conditions that we needed to do. The fact is the Medicaid program gets the best prices, and as does the VA. And the issue at that time was to keep a firewall between the two programs, and that was one of the conditions of keeping the coalition together.
Okay. Sorry, Jim.
Yes, and we'll have a representative from Pharma that will be up here shortly and can explain that further. Other questions? Okay. Andy?
Chair Greenlick, Chair Morissette, and committee members, my name is Andy Miller. I'm a senior policy analyst for the Oregon Business Association. I want to point out that it's OBA Association, not Alliance, Oregon Business Association. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about this Oregon prescription drug bulk purchasing program. OBA has been working on this expansion of the Oregon prescription drug program since 2004, including supporting Senate Bill 329 in the 2005 session, a very frustrating experience. We actively supported ballot Measure 44 and have been happy with the rapid implementation of the expanded program. To increase affordable health care options to all Oregonians, OBA supports expanding the Oregon prescription drug program to include private employers. This program is an excellent example of public-private partnership. Oregonians and businesses allowed to join will benefit from the negotiating power of a larger purchasing pool and will reduce the cost for prescription drugs. Adding private businesses will not increase the cost of this program unless we have amendments to the contrary, but will substantially increase the savings available to Oregonians. Prescription drugs account for 14% to 20% of overall premium costs. If the cost of this component is stabilized and or reduced, employers will see a reduction in overall cost of employer-sponsored health plans. And I can tell you from sitting in my health policy committee meeting that this is very, very important to our members. Everyone wants to do the right thing and provide good health care coverage, and it's becoming harder and harder. And we've had companies close small businesses because they couldn't cover their employees adequately. Opening the Oregon prescription drug program will lower the cost of health care, help increase Oregon's economic competitiveness, and benefit all regions of the state. OBA encourages you to support House Bill 2216 and Senate Bill 362. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you. I want go ahead. Go ahead. If you're through testifying, you may step down.
She's never through, Senator.
I just want to take a minute to maybe go back to the beginning of this, and Representative Greenlick mentioned 2003 when we did have, actually I'm going to start from the beginning and say that Representative Greenlick did have a bill on the House side that didn't go anywhere. We moved to the Senate side. It became Senate Bill 785. We met 875. Thank you, Jane. And so we spent a lot of time meeting with the pharmaceutical industry and all of the stakeholders, and we did have, I thought, a good meeting. I mean, we worked together to craft something that we felt was doable at the time, and we did exclude the as Representative Greenlick mentioned, the firewall that was with the Medicare, Medicaid group. We did try to expand it in 05 with Senate Bill 329, which did pass the Senate, and that it didn't go to the House. We did then, with the help of our friends, do an initiative which did pass that included the uninsured. So there's been an evolution of this effort, and with a lot of consultation with everyone that we could possibly talk with. And I must say we've had good relationship with the pharmaceutical industry. We've talked a lot about this, and I feel very comfortable having them give us their advice and so on, even though we may not listen to it. We want their input. But no, this has been...
We'll listen.
Of course we will listen. And this has been a good process, and I want to emphasize that. And so we're... now there is one other piece that we did have to negotiate with CMS, and that was whether or not the Medicare D cardholders would be eligible to participate in our program, and they said yes. They would not electronically keep track of their purchases at the pharmacy, but if they saved their receipts, then they could turn them into their private insurance company, and it is a private insurance, and that is another significant change that we did allow someone covered by private insurance into the program. So they use their card interchangeably. They can use it, and that will get them through the donut hole. They have to save their receipts, and then they can use that for out-of-pocket. So that's kind of the history of this. And so with that, we will continue. Yes.
If I might interrupt before you move to the next panel, I wonder if you could give some of the rationale for the ballot measure that did pass, not including the elements that we are including it in this particular bill, being the private entities and the labor organizations. Why were they left out at that point, and now we're coming to include them?
Well, as you notice, we didn't have any opposition. There were, I think there were 24... We want to keep it simple. We want to go to the for the uninsured. That was our goal with the ballot measure. And we kept it simple. And there was no opposition. That was a key to passage. It was a key to getting 129,000 signatures and not having to spend a lot of money during the general election. And so that was the plan.
And all along, we really took an incremental approach in this.
Yeah.
The basic notion was to move along a piece at a time, make sure it works, move the next piece in. The timing of the legislature makes it a little tough to be.
I probably would have been happier, Mr. Chair, had you not said it taking an incremental approach, because that means an egression to a point that might be a little conflicting for some folks.
We had, when we started the negotiations in 2003, we had a set of proposals to be included, and I think this bill completes the set of proposals that we had at that time. So it, and I think I need to go back and look at the records, but I think this is where we move. So we got it one piece in 2003. We attempted to get another piece in 2005. This is the piece we tried in 2005, and then Senator Morissette, who did most of the work on Measure 44, added the rest of the uninsured. So, I mean, there were building blocks, and this, if we pass this, will be the end of the building blocks that we started at in 2002 when we first started talking about it.
Thank you.
There are no plans to go beyond this. If that was your question, if that's what I heard in your
question. Oh, Alex. Probably a philosophical discussion we can engage.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, thank you, because I was part of that work group in 2003. And basically what we set up was we did what we did, and we were going to let that prove itself. And if it proved itself, go to the next step. And if that proved itself, go to the next step. We still haven't real good proof on step one. Step two is now in place, just barely started, and we're moving to step three. So this, we aren't doing this incrementally, and we aren't doing it, allowing it to prove itself over time.
Now, I will not call Missy Dolan back up to refute your argument.
About step one.
About all of it.
Well, specifically step two.
I think that we have proven the success. We have. I think we have. Rick Bennett, Art Towers, and Jane Netboy, would you please come up? Not Jerry. Did I say Jerry? Rick Bennett, Art Towers, Jane Netboy. Jerry, I'm saving you for last.
Oh.
If you don't mind.
Rick here?
Rick, are you here?
Yes, I don't need to speak. Thank you very much.
Okay, then just wait, Jerry. Just
okay. This is carefully orchestrated.
This is carefully orchestrated.
Thank you.
go ahead.
Right. Chair Greenlick, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm the political director for Service Employees Union, Local 503. And I'm here to testify in favor of the legislation before you. We've been proud to partner with you and work with your leadership on the legislation in 2003 and on the ballot measure in 2006. Our 40,000 members kicked in substantially to both efforts in terms of turning people out for testimony and for hearings, letter writing campaigns and grassroots lobbying, and then an awful lot of hard work during the ballot measure campaign as well. And we've been very pleased with the results to date. We have members in a variety of different sectors of the economy, ranging from nursing homes to in-home care, child care providers, our newest members, state employees, local government employees, and private nonprofit employees. And we see the rising cost of health care as a dramatic challenge facing working families. This program is proving itself as a means to lower one element of health care hyperinflation, prescription drug costs. So we're very pleased to come back and work with you now in year four of this effort to rein in prescription drug costs. And we do support these two pieces of legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Jane,
Netboy with the Multnomah County Democratic Health Committee Work Group. We did a lot on ballot measure 44 in 06, and we have taken this issue both to the state Democratic Convention and to our county Democratic Convention, and we support both issues. We realize that it is a common sense solution needed to help reduce health care costs and increase accountability. 2216 and 362 will further expand the prescription drug, providing more relief to Oregon families and businesses while reducing costs to our state budget. The bill will extend the list of individuals that may participate in the program by including private entities and labor groups. The higher the participation in the program, the greater the savings to all of us. Small businesses are saying that the cost of health care is their top concern. Allowing private entities and other groups to participate will be good economic development for Oregon. We support the passage of both of these bills, and you will be hearing more from us in support of them.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
John Powell, Chris Davies, would you please come up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. I have written testimony that's been distributed to you. My purpose in being here today is to speak in favor of workers' compensation insurers being included in this program. Although my testimony refers to this as an expansion, I'm not really sure whether it's an expansion or perhaps more a clarification. The workers' compensation premium that is paid in this state is probably going to reach $1 billion for the first time in 2007. We don't have the numbers for 2006 yet, but at the rate of progression that we're going, we're probably now a $1 billion industry. The largest component of that, of the premium dollar, is spent on medical costs, and that number has gone from 36% to 44% in the 10 years from 1995 to 2005. And then even within medical costs, the fastest growing component of that has been pharmacies. And the Department of Consumer and Business Services have published a study that shows that from 1999 to 2003, the annual rate of growth of pharmacy costs was 19.5% per year, compared to an inflation rate of 5.8% for medical as a whole. So access to this program will serve a public purpose by controlling the growth of workers' compensation costs, and of course it does nothing to limit or hinder the benefit or the access to the benefit for injured workers. And from conversations that we've had with OPDP and DCBS, we believe that they're both supportive of this change. I say that I'm not sure whether this is an expansion or a clarification because we believe that Safe Corporation already qualifies as a covered entity or a participant as it's described in the statute. The proposed bill or proposed amendment adds private entities, and I assume that private entities would then include private insurance companies and self-insured employers who would be purchasing drugs for injured workers for whom they are providing insurance coverage. And we're supportive of that. We think that if it's good for SAFE to be part of this program, then the rest of the providers of workers' comp insurance should have that access too. So I'm not sure whether this is something that would require another amendment to explicitly lay out that workers' comp insurers are included, but we think that would be a valuable clarification in this bill and in the statute. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Co-chair.
Thank you, sir.
The end of your second paragraph of your written testimony?
Yes.
It talks about topping $16 million. What's topping $16
million? Mr. Chair, Chair Greenlee, the amount that is spent on pharmacy services for workers' compensation benefits in 2004 was $16 million.
You said,
can I follow?
Yeah. You said roughly 35% of the billion would be spent on medical care?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, in 2005, 44% of the premium dollar was spent on medical care.
That would be $400 million on medical care?
Right.
And of the $400 million, there's only $16 million in pharmacy?
DCBS's estimate is currently 6.2% of medical costs is pharmacy, for pharmacy billings. I hope those numbers pan out.
That's pretty low. 6% of the 36%. 2%. Of the billion. Right. I'll puzzle
I'll
that.
I'll make a pie chart for you.
I'm trying to get my zeros in the right place there. Too many zeros. Thank you, sir.
Okay. John, do you have any clarification?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you know better than that. I never clarify things. In fact, that's why I'm here, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill obviously expands the benefit to people who are insured. And the reason for my appearance here today is to discuss with you just briefly the potential need for a definition of underinsured. Obviously, some people have talked about high deductibles of $5,000 as being, quote, underinsured. However, in many of the health plans today, and those of you who participate through the PET program with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon would know that there are tiers that provide higher benefits for using generics, pays at a higher rate, and that sort of thing. If underinsured would mean that somebody with chronic diseases could simply avoid any kind of management, pharmaceutical management as part of a health plan by joining this plan, there could be some shift, and this just came to my attention today, so we haven't had a chance to really think through it. In fact, it might get chronic cases out of the insured population into this program, which could be a cost savings overall to the employer who had the plan. We have not figured all that out. However, we do question what that means in terms of underinsured. As you know, many of the health plans today have case management for chronic diseases and participate according to the purchasing of the pharmacy benefit along with the physician and other medical benefits. So we are concerned about that question and wanted to raise it today so that we'd be at the table.
Okay. questions.
Thank you. Okay, Jerry, it's time. Jim Gardner, would you please come up? Jerry and Jim.
Well, Chairman Borsett, esteemed Chairman Greenlick when he returns, Vice Chair Cruz, and fellow members of the committees. My name for the record is Jerry Cohn. I'm State Director for AARP. It's just AARP, an organization for people who celebrate birthdays. last tagline.
And yours is coming up soon.
And mine is coming up soon.
And then you will be eligible, right?
I've been eligible for 5 years, sir.
Oh.
So, for the discounts. You can join at any age. But a little promo here. We are, and to explain who we are, we are a nonprofit membership organization for generations. And while most of you may get that letter when you are closing in on age 50, indeed, we are looking at issues across generations. And that's why we're proud to be in support of House Bill 2216. And I must amend I have a handout that I believe has been provided to the committee members. If not, it will be forthcoming. But I must amend this to include also Senate Bill 362. I'll be brief because I believe that the other proponents of these measures have very eloquently already presented some very cogent numbers. They presented the faces and the level of engagement that Oregonians have placed into this effort for a number of years. In our case, as documented in my written testimony, we've been pleased to work on not only the initial legislation, the Senate Bill 875, but the outreach efforts in enrollment. In particular, our work with Senator Morissette as co-sponsors of the initiative that led to Measure 44 and some heavy lifting by a number of great organizations. And I'd be shameful not to mention SEIU in terms of their partnership and support on that. But we're here today to support expansion because it's a common sense approach. It's using the power of the marketplace. In our case of our AARP membership nationwide with 38 million, we have almost a half million members here. Over half of them are not retirees, not retired, and so their ability to benefit is just as significant in terms of this type of program. I'll zero in on just one piece of my written testimony, and that is, as a number of us advocates around 875 and most recently Measure 44 touched upon and met with business leaders, editorial board writers, editors, and the public at large, all of them seem to ask, well, why can't I be included as well? So I think a number of you have raised those questions already. Our sense was, again, apply the common sense to as many Oregonians as possible and let the marketplace work as it should. So on that, I'll, as I said, keep my oral comments brief, and we look forward to any questions you might have.
Okay. Questions?
Mr. Chair,
yes. Just a comment, because 5 years ago I was shocked and offended when I got a letter, and having nothing to do with the organization, and they keep sending me stuff, and I keep trying to live in denial, and organizations like this keep pointing out things that I don't want to face. So, but other than that.
Well, we'd like you to face aging in a positive sense, though.
I just want to stay young.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Sure. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association of America, in my frequent role of lonely dissent. would just say by way of background, Pharma is the national trade association for the major research-based pharmaceutical manufacturers, which discover, develop, and market a large majority of brand name drugs. A little trip backward in time, two sessions. You've heard about what I consider one of the finest work groups I've had the opportunity to participate in. A work group that epitomized bipartisan spirit, private public cooperation, the work group that brought us Senate Bill 875, which is the precursor to the now expanded prescription drug program. That, as I think Senator Cruz eloquently stated, was really based on an approach of a step at a time. And the step that was taken initially, to which we agreed, was to create a purchasing pool that had as its foundation public sector entities, both local and state public sector entities, and then that also included a defined segment of the uninsured population, 55 and above, under 185% of poverty, and basically to use that as a kind of trial to see how it worked. There was an effort in the 2005 session, which we were unable to support, which would have expanded the program in much the same way that this proposed legislation would have expanded it, and for many of the reasons that I'm going to go into in just a little while in a bit more detail, we were compelled to oppose that particular expansion. By contrast, when Senator Morissette brought forward to the electorate Ballot Measure 44, we did not oppose it. We did not actively participate in the campaign either way, but we were not in opposition to it. We didn't spend any resources to oppose it. And in essence, I think that the reason that for that was that it adhered to the philosophy of trying to focus benefit on the uninsured population and basically remove the barriers of age and the barriers of an income limitation to participation in that pool, and I'm proud to say we did not oppose it. This particular bill, like the bill last session, I think raises some additional policy issues in the form of potential unintended consequences, and I'm going to. One of those is addressed in my written testimony, and the other really is addressed in the form of the Dash 2 amendments. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to also have an opportunity to perhaps discuss some of the policy issues around the Dash 2s. And there's a document I know that Senator Cruz has that at the proper time we can use to facilitate that discussion. The issue with regard to expansion to private employers without limitation, so the Nikes of the world, the Intels of the world, et cetera, as well as mom and pop on Main Street are all eligible under this amendment. The issue is in this, what I would characterize as a volatile marketplace for health care, both on the purchaser side and on the provider side. The question I think we need to ask ourselves is there any risk, and if so, how much of a risk is there, that this could create a temptation of what is termed crowd out? And basically what that means is there any risk that an employer, perhaps confronted with severe cost pressures overall on the healthcare side, not only on prescription drugs, but because of hospitalization and physician outpatient and other components of the healthcare spectrum, any risk that there would be a temptation essentially to use the eligibility to participate in this pool as essentially a pretext to drop RX coverage. I don't know how serious that risk is.
I do have the example that's contained in my testimony from Maine. That's the difference is that was a funded program. But it drew particularly small business. It drew them through dramatic numbers of them who were previously privately insured into that state program. So we do know that when we have a funded program, the risk of crowded is very real. The question is, when we have what is essentially a discount card, does that create a risk of crowd out in the form of businesses essentially dumbing down their health care coverage on the pretext that you've got this discount program to deal with? Here's perhaps a flexible benefit account of X amount, and that's all you're going to get. I don't know the answer to that question. I do believe it's a risk, and I believe it's something that you need to take into account in terms of making a determination of whether you want to simply open the doors to every private entity from the barbershop on the corner to Intel and Nike to participate. If I may turn to the Dash 2s, and if I could perhaps, with your permission, Mr. Chair, distribute what I have called price comparisons under Senate Bill 362-2. Representative Greenlake, Co-Chair Greenlake, was correct when he, and as was Representative Brunn, when they identified the language. The policy objective of this program from the very inception has been to achieve the lowest possible prices for participants in the program. And the sort of operative assumption has been, the unspoken premise has been, that the lowest possible prices could be achieved for eligible Oregonians solely under the aegis of this program. And that's a proposition that that I think we need to question and test against the data. The data are easily available, and you'll see some of them, just a smattering of it in the chart that I have provided. And a lot has happened in the marketplace for particularly generic drugs since we first passed Senate Bill 875. We're all familiar with the $4 RX program that Walmart rolled out nationally and in Oregon some months ago. And I must also say, by way of disclaimer to the committee, that Walmart is another client of mine, though I'm not appearing on their behalf today. But quickly following suit on the $4 RX announcement, Target reduced and matched those prices. Costco dropped its prices. Not all of the competitors among the large pharmacies did so, but clearly a great deal of dynamism is now operating in that market. And so the question becomes, where's the best deal for the consumer? Is the best deal, in fact, under the state-run prescription drug program, or might it be, at least on occasion, with regard to specific generic drugs, in the private sector, outside of the program, quite apart from the program, on the part of pharmacy chains that may or may not participate in the program? This is what the chart, in effect, attempts to... This is the data that the chart attempts to tease out. And what I have done, and I was kind of amused by the protestations of the cost of comparing the developing this data, because it took me about 20 minutes on my computer to pull this up. It's all on the internet, at least for the big chains. To their credit, they've made this data available. It's very easy to assemble. And if you don't want to pay for it, you could probably get AARP or another good volunteer group to volunteer to do it. I'm sure as a service to their members. Let's just take a look, if I could.
Excuse me, just a moment. The interesting thing about the Medicare D program is that we can participate, they can get our card, and they can do that. They don't have to use our card. They have two cards. They have the private insurance card. They have our card. They can walk up to the pharmacist and say, what's the best deal? And take the best deal. So I don't understand, you know, this, the survey stuff. Every individual has that opportunity. And this is a discount program. They don't have to join. They don't have to pay dues. They simply have another option that they can compare against any other card they have. And I don't know if John is still here, but I think that this is a competitive kind of thing. And, you know, the we're not carving out the pharmaceuticals from a private company with this because it's an individual decision. And who's the judge of underinsured? Well, I think the individual is the judge of underinsured. And if they can get a better deal with this card, then they can take it. Otherwise, they can stay with the other. There may be compelling reasons not to use the card. So,
Mr. Chair, I don't disagree at all with the eligibility of Part D participants and eligibles. I think that's that was good public policy on your part. And I'm not going to address the underinsured issue because I really don't have the technical expertise on that one. But what I do, with your permission, would like to do is simply to sort of elucidate what the data show with regard to price. Price inside the program and price outside the program. Because I think our mutual objective is to achieve lowest price, lowest cost, through whatever means, through either pure private sector, the purchasing pool, or some combination thereof. I took as the basis for the snapshot a 30-day supply of two very commonly prescribed hypertension medications, Atenolol and Lisinopril. And what we have, two chains which participate in the program, Walmart and Rite Aid, and two that do not, Costco and Target. And what you see very clearly is that the price difference, to take the Rite Aid example, the price premium over the Walmart and Target prices is 200%. That's essentially how much you can save half of the, you can get the drug for half the price you can at one of these pharmacies if you're a good shopper and you check out the sources. If you look back up at the Q&A from the frequently asked questions on the Oregon Prescription Drug Program's website, you'll say, well, how much of a discount can I get? Average probably 30%, but can be as high as 60%. I submit to you that the difference you can achieve, the savings you can achieve simply by careful and assiduous shopping exceeds the discount available from the program. And when you take it down to Lisinopril, that point is made in spades. There, the price difference is 475%. That's the difference between the Walmart price, let's say, and the Rite Aid price. You can check all of these things are on the internet. So what I'm suggesting is that as a complement, essentially as a market check on the value of this program, the Dash 2s would, in a very straightforward way, facilitate comparison shopping by people who are eligible or who are participants in the prescription drug plan. It's based on a bill that Senator Bates, then Representative Bates, put forward two sessions ago, which generated a great deal of interest and support. It got lost in the shuffle, you know, through some machinations that I won't bore you with. It was a good concept then. It's a good concept now. And I think, I honestly believe that it is a supplementary tool that would help you accomplish the objective of this program, which is to figure out how to get the lowest price of drugs, particularly generics, to Oregon consumers.
Thank you for your support. Missy, would you come up, please? And Jim, you can stay if you like.
Tell me my choreography moves.
Yeah, stay, because you may want to get into the conversation.
Chair Morris said, and members of the committee, I would just like to talk about what Jim was talking about the price comparison. For one thing, when we give a discount, we don't go to Rite Aid and say, give us a discount on this $7.99 price. we actually have a discount based on the first data bank average wholesale price. So if it's 60% on a generic, then it's off of the same AWP, average wholesale price, and the price is the same at every pharmacy, whether it's Rite Aid, Walmart, Costco, or Target. It doesn't matter what they would charge me if I came in without insurance. It matters what the first database AWP amount is. And our discount, especially on generics, is very high. Our average discount off of AWP for this program so far is 54%. So it doesn't matter that every pharmacy in the state is going to have a different price for their drugs. That's the way of doing business. But it is all based on some database for the average wholesale price. Our members are advised by our staff to price shop. We say, yes, Medicare members, if you are with Regents or Health Net and they give you a discount when you're in the donut hole, then make sure that our discount is better before you use that card, because you've got a manual process ahead of you. We encourage our non-Medicare people to do the same. We've had calls saying in the under the old contract, hey, Costco gives me a better price on this drug. We said, go to Costco for Christ's sake. We don't want them to pay more. We know that our competitive contract right now has demonstrated savings for that big group. We've got a good program.
Just let me get a clarification here. So with the card, with your card, any pharmacy I go to that's in the program, I'm going to pay the same price for whatever drug I'm buying. Is that correct?
If it's the identical NDC number. And let me tell you that if you're looking at something that's an equivalent of a Lipitor, like Jim was suggesting, it can have the ND. There can be, you know, dozens of different NDCs. So your prescription might even change every time you go to the doctor. He might tweak it a bit. So if it's the exact NDC number, yes, because and it's got to be the same day too. And excuse me, Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, for answering that wrong.
NDC
is the
National Drug Code.
Thank you, Jim.
It's the it's the chemical makeup.
Right? Yeah. Well, excuse me. I think it's important to define the terms.
Okay, I apologize.
Yeah, okay. So NDC is?
National Drug Code.
Very good. Thank you.
And that code is assigned to each
formulation.
Yeah. Formulation.
Yeah. Okay. Follow up, Ms. Chair? Yes. Okay, so theoretically, because you have all of the drugstores on your panel, and you come up with a price. So theoretically, with that card, I could go in to Walmart and end up paying more than I could buy it off the shelf. Is that true? If I wasn't paying any attention to this, went in and said, I want this drug, here's my card.
No, because usual and customary, it always defaults to the lesser, excuse me, Chair Morissette, yeah, and Senator Cruz, it always defaults to the lower of. So if Walmart has a price of $4 and our price is higher than that, mm-hmm, it defaults to UCR.
It automatically. I don't have to ask.
Automatically.
It just does that.
Automatically. Exactly. That's how it's priced. Pharmacist goes to the computer, punches in the ID card. MedImpact does the calculation. They know UCR has to be input if it's $4, and that's less than ours. We've actually done a survey of when Walmart released the $4 generic list. You know that there are over 9,000 generics, and their generic discounts were only available on maybe 150 to a couple hundred. So And we did a price comparison, a random sampling of about 30%. Some of the $4 prices were better than ours, others weren't. And we have notified our members when they call us and say, well, shouldn't I just go buy the $4 ones? We say, check the price, because they can check it on the computer, or we check it for them.
Okay, one more follow-up, Ms. Chair. Okay. In my town, my theoretical town, because I don't actually own one, but...
But you do represent.
I do represent several, actually. Okay, in my town, I have a Rite Aid and a Target. One's on your panel, one is not. How am I going to know that I could get the same drug cheaper at Target with your program?
Well, Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, the way that you're going to know that the butter that you buy at Albertsons is cheaper than the butter you buy at Safeway, you know, there has to be a certain accountability by purchasers that we don't have a government institution that's giving a pricing for groceries to make sure that people know that they need to price shop.
One more follow-up, Ms. Chair. But you said in your earlier testimony that this is the best thing out there, the best thing since sliced bread, and I get the card. I'm going to assume that. I'm not going to look. So how am I going to know that? Because I'm assuming you, government, are doing the very best thing for me that's possible.
Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, I would hope that this is the best thing out there.
Okay, time out. This is a discount program. It's not an insurance program. You get the card, and you go to your pharmacy, and you give them the card, and you can price shop, but they'll give you the best price available. And if the Walmart price is better than this card price, they'll give it to you. So it's an individual discount.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, but if the pharmacy with the lowest price didn't in the panel, there's no way you're going to know that.
Well, then you better... Okay, I would suggest that people shop around then to see if there is a place that it's cheaper. I suspect that there's an effort to paint this as a government-run program. This is not a government-run program. It's a government facilitation of a discount program. And each individual who has the card can use it with whatever else they have. So if you have a Blue Shield, I have a Regions card. I get a really good discount. I'm going to try it just to see if I get a better discount with this card, and I probably won't. And if I did, I'd be really upset because I get a really, really good discount with Regions. So this is, I just think this is an individual kind of thing that people have to look at, and we don't, you know, this program doesn't guarantee the price. Now, okay, I'll let it go.
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick question. I don't know that this panel is necessarily the right one to answer this. I've heard a little bit from pharmaceuticals. How are pharmacies affected? How would a Rite Aid or a Safeway or a Costco, from a bottom line perspective?
Yeah.
I just want to say that as of today, we have had 443 of the approximately 700 pharmacies in the state voluntarily sign up. And of that, 92 are independents. And we have, on the new contract, with the new terms, 15 new independents that have come on board. We have received over 200 pharmacies applying in the past 2 weeks, because we sent out an alert saying you're going to be terminated as of January 31st under the old contract, and they had just, as I said earlier, neglected the faxes that they had received from us, and they are pouring in on a daily basis. I expect that we will soon be up to the number of pharmacies that we had previously. How are they affected? They're giving us discounts. I think that they are changing the way that they're doing business by coming into this program because they're offering cash-paying uninsured people the discount that insured people are receiving. And they're making that decision. For whatever reason, they're making that decision. I think they don't want to lose the business.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I have a question. Thank you. Mr. Gardner, thank you for your testimony. Maybe I'm missing something here. I'm going to backtrack, actually, to your first point about how you said that the expansion of the prescription drug purchasing program could provide an incentive for some employees to drop drug coverage. But in light of the fact that the plan already allows residents of the state who do not have prescription drug coverage to enroll, I don't understand why amending the plan to allow public sector employees would cause that to happen. I see it more as the opposite, that the public sector employer or the private sector employers might say, this would be good for our employees, maybe we should join. So I see it as more the reverse. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I think there is a scenario in which under the current program, an employer could simply say, we're not going to give you RX coverage anymore, you're on your own. And basically, something like a crowd-out phenomenon would occur under that scenario. But I think the risk is whether or not an employer as a participant could essentially portray this or characterize it as part of the health benefit that that employer is offering to its employees. And it would be essentially portrayed as a benefit, but it would simply be a discount card. Now, as I said, as I tried to make abundantly clear, I don't know what the probability of that risk is, but I think it's at least in terms of how it could be couched as a human resource tool, it's different if the employer can basically say, this is the benefit I am offering you, as opposed to, I am terminating your benefits and you're on your own.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yes.
Is there any indication that any of that's happened since the provision that residents of the state who do not have prescription drug coverage has been in effect?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, we have had very limited experience with the program since the expansion. I don't believe there's any evidence that under the more limited version of the program, which was limited to 55 and above and 185 of poverty, I'm not aware of any indication that that was an incentive that has induced employers to drop coverage. I do think that there's a lot of pressure on employers generally on that on the healthcare cost front. So I think the risk may, particularly if you were to pass this bill with the employer participation option, the risk is greater now than it would have been in the past.
Yes.
Quick question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while Ms. Dolan is up here, and probably be the precise person to answer the question, and that is, since this program launched, and as I understand the discussion as it's evolving, that school districts and other local entities, public entities, were included in the program. And how many are currently participating in the program? Now, you've given us individual numbers, but for those...
Chair Morrison and Representative Flores, thank you for your question. In January of 2006, we had approximately 4,000 lives from public sector businesses. That was from three different groups. The school district that was involved with the program left because they had some substantial medical losses on their medical side of the business, and they decided to go to a fully insured program. The other group, PEB, in three different counties, 2,700 member life, came into the program for approximately 10 months. The reason that they left was their health plan did business through a PBM for 12,000 other member, members that they were administering, and they wanted to use one PBM instead of two, so it was administrative efficiency. The last group is still in. It's got 500 lives, Southern Oregon Head Start. They've been in since June of 2005 after we went live, and they continue to renew with us, and they were very pleased with the ODS rates. One of the issues that I tried to point out in my presentation earlier is that my focus, and the program's focus in 2006 was not on group anymore. It was on the strategic positioning that would give us a better, more attractive group product so that we could have a better offering to groups. So we didn't see any growth at all. You don't want to bring a group on in June or July and say, by the way, in February we're moving. And so we had to suspend group growth for that reason.
I'd like to add to that. There was some discussion in 2003 whether or not PEB should become part of this plan, and the suggestion was, why don't we order PEB to become part of the plan? In fact, Jim Gardner shaking his head. The response was, PEB is a negotiated plan. There's a union that negotiates. Secondly, the director of PEB said, I will not enroll in a plan that's going to end up costing the state more money, period. So if Regents has a better deal on the pharmaceuticals, and it's a package. And so if you carve out pharmaceuticals, that may raise the price of your other part of the package. And, you know, the business part of the issue is we're not going to do something that's going to cost more money for the package. So this is, again, something that you can't dictate because it's a union-negotiated plan, and secondly, it has to save money. And if it doesn't meet those, well, if it doesn't save money, then they're not going to do it. So PEB does the prudent thing. If it benefits the total package, they'll get in. If it doesn't benefit the total package, they won't. And I think Regents is, as I remember, got 3 million lives and that they negotiate for. That's pretty hard to beat. They have a pretty good... it's maybe more than that, but you know, it's a good purchasing pool. So, yes.
Chair Morissette, I would just like to comment on a couple of other points that Jim made. I think that you can look at the groups possibly dropping their RX coverage and coming into this program as a glass half full, glass half empty. And I would like to present that I have actually met with the workers' comp stakeholders, and what they wanted to do was to communicate with all of their groups who currently do not offer any medical at all except for workers' comp about this program, saying, look, you know, you've got workers' comp, but you don't have medical. Make sure all of your employees are signed up with this program. So, yeah, there might be, as Jim says, a chance that some employer who can't afford medical would say, well, I could give you the RX through this and I don't have to pay for it. But I think there's an even greater chance that people, employers who are not offering any medical benefit are going to encourage their employees to sign up through this program. Another point on his handout in his second bullet, he brings up the fact of formulary management being an issue. And I just want you to know that the OPDP does not require a formulary. Yes, we were required by statute to develop an evidence-based formulary at lowest cost. However, it is not mandatory that our groups accept it. They can accept our formulary, they can accept ODS's formulary, or they can say, we want an open formulary. It's their benefit package. They say what the terms are. And so this is a non-issue for the OPDP.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to focus back really quickly on where I think that Missy and I have a point of agreement, though perhaps a different structural response to that point of agreement, and that is on the issue of consumer price comparison. I think that we are agreed that it's important for consumers to be avid price shoppers, to look at prices within the program and not prices outside of the program and compare and to get the lowest price. The policy argument, I think, in favor of the Dash 2s is ultimately grounded on the fact that we have a historic lack of transparency in the medical marketplace. People don't comparison shop for a variety of reasons, because of third-party payer phenomenon historically, but they simply don't do it regularly in the same way that they price shop for milk or bread. They're doing it more now, but they don't do it in the same way. The very fact that these price disparities that I've documented for you exist is evidence that we don't have perfect competition, as an economist would define it, in this market. What the tool that I have suggested, and that Senator Cruz has brought forward in the Dash 2, is basically, rather than, you know, on a sort of piecemeal basis, encourage people to individually check the prices, or have Missy's staff help them check the prices, is to use the benefits of modern technology and a website, frankly, to make that that kind of comparison easy to access, so that we do encourage genuine price competition.
I like Senator Cruz's earlier suggestion, in a different time and a different place, that individuals have to be responsible for their own medical care. That's up to them. You know, we want individuals. We don't want big government, or we don't want some entity to lay everything all out for them and take the responsibility. It's up to the individual. So I do agree with that.
As do I.
Yes.
Senator Chair Morissette and Vice Chair Cruz and committee members, I found this discussion very illuminating, and your questions as well. I wanted to just pipe in on 4 points raised in this discussion. First, I have to also, on behalf of ARP, Laud, Walmart, Target, and other organizations, other pharmacies that are starting to utilize that power of the marketplace. But as Missy has noted, Walmart alone, there's a much narrower band of medications that are covered for that $4. So we have a long way to go, and I certainly wouldn't be resting our laurels on the Walmarts, Targets, and Costcos of the world to ultimately rein in. But it's a good trend, and we salute that. The second, and I'd like to jump into the language of Nike, Intel, and then pointing out small employers. The reality is that almost 90% of employers, as you may well be aware of in the state, have less than 19 employees. And again, we know from AARP watchdog, prescription drug watchdog trends, we do some significant tracking of industry practices, of trends in the public and private sector, that indeed we know the trend has been more and more employers, you know, either raising premiums, cost sharing, providing, in essence, under insurance of prescription drugs, or dropping coverage. So I think, we all understand, while there may be a concerted crowding out, the trends are already there in terms of the burden on employers, and this is within the context of the broader issue of health care reform. So, you know, health care in general in this country is where we're talking about the focus, and this is a piece of it. Third, I welcome the challenge of AARP volunteers, members of all ages, jumping into help to price comparisons. And I would like to point out to this committee that in the state of New York, AARP New York has endeavored and carried out such a program. It has been with significant funding, I must point out, provided by the Attorney General of the state, now the mayor, governor of the state, but Attorney General Spitzer made it a priority to provide the type of funding to make sure that data was collected and posted and maintained in usable fashion. And, of course, the individuals were screened. You don't just say, hey, would you like to volunteer? You do want to make sure there's credible tracking of the information. And so that money came out of taxpayers, out of settlements. So I would point out, well, certainly novel idea, it's basically an investment as to that type of support. But we certainly have, at the moment in my office, are about 35 volunteers who are going through orientation on the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, the next wave of outreach in community, but also in communication with your pharmacy and your physician to get and understand how you as an individual can take personal responsibility, including looking for and pricing medications and your health care. And I think those will be the, I'm looking at my checklist of points that I was going to raise, but I think that probably wears on time for all of you.
That's why I kept you up here.
Yes.
Well, no. I value your input because you do represent a large organization, many volunteers who have been involved in this program and will continue to be involved, so I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Unless there are other comments, we're going to close the public hearing. So we will
thank
close.
You.
As acting vice chair of the House Committee on Healthcare, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2216. And as Representative Greenlick asked me to do, he would like to know that you to know that you're invited to stay for the Senate work session on the Senate bill, but I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Healthcare.
And we will open a work session on Senate Bill 362. We have two amendments. You want to tell us what the amendments are?
Sure.
Amendment number one.
The dash one amendment removes the audit requirement from Senate Bill 362. It changes the application process to remove the annual application requirement. The dash two amendment requires the administrator of OPDP to develop a survey about prescription drug prices and produce a prescription drug comparison list report for at least 25 of the most frequently used drugs.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 362.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 362. Discussion? Yes. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I'm opposed to the dash one amendment. Quite simply, I think the amendment itself is probably good, but unfortunately it removes what I think is the best part of the bill, which is to have the program report back to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee so we can get the sort of performance review that we're supposed to be getting. And I'm not sure why it was deemed necessary to remove the legislative oversight, which the dash one does. And I think legislative oversight is something we don't do enough of, and I wish that was going to still be in the bill.
Thank you. I think the legislative oversight is built into the process, and I think that's in some ways a redundancy, and that we will have legislative oversight.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would just say that the Legislative Audit Committee is the appropriate place to really get into numbers.
Okay. Thank you. Other comments? Other objections? Would you call the roll, please?
Senator George.
Excuse.
Senator
Moss
Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
No.
Chair Morissette.
Aye. Dash one amendments.
Okay. As we
dash two.
As we continue on this
dash
line. She already did. She did.
Oh, you did it all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 362.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 362. Any discussion? Senator, do I see any other discussion? Senator Cruz, you're the one who was talking. I couldn't tell who that was.
Surprisingly enough, that was me.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Gardner pretty much explained what the amendment will do, but and I just want to make a couple other small little points. And you're right. If we can ever get to the point in our society where people are taking responsibility for their own health care, that would be wonderful. And I hope we drive towards that point. But we're not there. People are used to, and it's part of our culture that we just we don't shop. You know, you go to the doctor, you never ask the price. You never ask the price for anything. And my fear is that and if indeed this is not a government program, but it's the oversight and communication is a government function. And so I'm thinking that the people are going to say they got this card, they go to any pharmacy they want, they're going to get the best price, and they're not going to check. And I think in the spirit of trying to get to transparency and eventually trying to get to true costs in medicine, which we are so incredibly far away from at the present time, I think having a tool to where they could see that there may be other options out there is going to inform them and also help us in the culture shift that needs to happen to get people to be aware of the cost of health care and the fact that they have other options out there. And I don't think it's going to cost that much. And you notice that it says they will develop a comparison report on 25 or more drugs. Now, you can't tell me developing a comparison report on 25 drugs is going to cost that much money. So I think this is a reasonable approach. It's an appropriate approach, and it gets us to the sort of information that has been sort of lacking in our healthcare system.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Monahan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 2s, at this point in time, I feel I would rather wait and go with the way the Dash 1s and the original bill is, just for simplicity purposes and cost purposes.
Thank you. I, too, feel that this is part of the program. This will be part of the program. As the program goes, ODS has done a fantastic job in integrating themselves into the program, in assuming some of the cost of the program and doing the registration with their staffing. I think the idea is, as the consortium grows, as the program grows, that a lot of these components are going to be there. They're simply going to be an integral part of it. There would be a significant cost, I think, to suddenly send this bill to Ways and Means and have them tell us how much it's going to cost immediately for us to do something that's going to come along as a natural part of doing business. So, other comments? Okay. The clerk.
Call Senator George.
Excuse.
Senator Montanus.
No.
Senator Burgess.
No.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Morissette.
No. Dash 2 amendments fail.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 362 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves 362 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. You want to carry the bill, right?
No,
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't support the bill, and I can't support the bill. You asked me earlier if we included my amendment, could I? And if we had, I think I could have. But the fact that the wrong amendment was adopted and the right amendment failed, I think, is the reason I can't support it. I think the transparency would have been important. I don't know how we can assume that sort of thing's going to happen on its own, because it won't. It never does unless we require it. And I think that would have been an important piece of moving us towards the sort of consumer culture that we need in healthcare that we clearly don't have. And the other part, removing the legislative, the directed legislative oversight for the program, which we have not had. I mean, let's keep in mind we did this. This will be the second change in less than 3 months, and we don't even know how the first change is going to do. So, I mean, we're moving at light speed on something, and when we do pilot projects in any other area of state government, we move slowly to make sure all things work before we expand. We are not doing that on this. So, therefore, I cannot support it.
But you did make a motion for a due pass. So
Mr. Chair, I did do that because I'm your vice chair, and I'm here to serve the chair.
And you are loyal. And also, I think that you obviously add a lot to this discussion that we're having now. I mean, I appreciate your participation, your active participation, and you brought forth an amendment, and I did say if I hadn't read the amendment when I said
true.
That, though.
True. And Mr. Chair, I support the goals here. I truly do.
I know. Okay. Okay. Other discussion? Yes.
Mr. Chair, we never come out with the best decision if everybody at the table agrees. There's always something about a discussion where they have more than one viewpoint that you come out with a far better decision, and I think that this exemplifies that. One of the top three automakers said that they really couldn't be considered a car company as they were writing their layoff list. They were really a medical insurance company on wheels. I think we have a serious problem. I don't know that we can move fast enough for the people who have no insurance and who are facing crises in their life, and they never know exactly what's going to happen. And to have a loved one very ill and not be able to have access to the proper medications and medical help has to be a terrifying and a sad experience. So I believe that this is a step in a direction to try to help uninsured Oregonians, and I am very happy today to support the bill.
Thank you. Senator Montesanders.
I think the program's been, thank you, Mr. Chair, extremely successful to date. We have helped so many Oregonians, and we need to continue to help even more Oregonians.
Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Excuse. Senator
Montanus.
Yes.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
No.
Chair Morissette.
Aye.
I really don't want to carry it, so I think Senate Bill 362 has a constitutional majority and passes, and I will carry the bill. Thank you. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.